The horrific trauma and undaunted courage of refugee families.
Every refugee family I have worked with has had some version of this. I work with kids who've seen their mothers raped, their father's finger sliced off. One kid saw a bullet put in his grandmother's head because she refused to let the rebels take him to be a child soldier. Their journeys are haunting. But what I get to see every day is hope, resilience, determination, a love of life and appreciation for being able to rebuild their lives.
That's Luma Mufle giving her TED Talk about her work with refugee children. We talk with her about her spellbinding book, Learning America, One Woman's Fight for Educational Justice for Refugee Children. Then for Earth Day, we re-air our 2017 interview with NASA climate scientist Peter Kalmus about his book, Being the Change. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The global refugee population has more than doubled in the past decade. Over 83 million people have been forced to leave their homes, and that's before Russia's genocidal war on Ukraine that's creating a tidal wave of additional refugees. Their problems aren't over, even when or if they receive asylum in another country. Prejudice and resentment combine with indifference, or worse, to isolate refugees and thwart their chances for success. In the U.S., kids who may be unable to read in English or in any language due to having grown up without schooling are thrown into inferior schools where their academic and social needs are ignored. Luma Mufle decided to do something about it. She's a refugee herself. As a gay woman, she faces the death penalty if she returns to the country of her birth, Jordan. Her book, Learning America, is a gripping account of her fight for educational justice for refugee children. She's the founder and director of The Fugees, a nonprofit organization devoted to working with child survivors of war. Mufle's vision began as a soccer team and tutoring program, but has grown to include schools serving high school and middle school students in Clarkson, Georgia, and Columbus, Ohio. It also has a program to train school districts in the Fuji approach. Luma Mufle, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca, for having me.
In this terrific book, Learning America, One Woman's Fight for Educational Justice for Refugee Children, you open the book with a soccer game that you came upon in the street. Tell us the story.
Yeah, the story goes back to 2004. I was living right outside of Atlanta, Georgia, and I was on my way to a grocery store, and on my way back, I missed my turn to go home, ended up having to U-turn into this apartment complex, and there's a group of kids out there playing soccer. They were playing with rocks set up as goals and a really raggedy soccer ball. The boys that were out there playing were from Afghanistan, Sudan, Liberia. The scene reminded me of home. I grew up in the Middle East in Amman, Jordan, and it was what I had missed about home and about the game. No parents, no coaches, no perfect pitches, just kids playing and arguing and loving the game. And I watched the kids for a bit, and I'd been coaching club soccer in the area for a while. So I had some soccer balls in my trunk, got out of my car, had the soccer ball in my hand. The boys rushed me. They wanted the ball. I wanted to play. And so we haggled, and they got the ball, and I got to play. So that's how it all started.
It's an incredible story. And before I go back to them, the Fugees, as they ended up being called when you organized them into a team, your family were refugees, much like these kids were refugees as well. Briefly tell us your family's story.
Yeah, my mom's family, they're Syrian, And they left Syria during the first Assad regime back in the 60s. Turmoil had started. Another group was trying to overthrow the government. My grandmother's maternal instincts were like, nope, this is going to go south really quickly. So she packed up the car, her five kids. She was pregnant with a sixth, and drove to neighboring Jordan. My mom was 16 at the time. My grandfather refused to leave. He's saying, oh, this is going to blow over. It's just, this happens every couple of years. But then he ended up joining her a couple of months later when his factory was seized by the government, and his brothers were arrested and they disappeared. And so they left, started anew in a neighboring country. They knew the language, but were still other, and were forced to leave everything they knew. And then I was born 11 years later in Amman.
You say that everyone has a breaking point when they know it's time to go. We are seeing a huge mass exodus out of Ukraine now because of, you know, the horrific bombing by the Russians. But you had a different situation in Syria. You have worked with refugees from all over, including, I'm thinking of one family from Afghanistan. Talk a little bit about what it takes for people to leave.
I mean, I would probably ask, like the people listening, what would it take for you to leave your home, your country, your family? Everybody has that different breaking point. You know, for my grandmother, like, she just felt it. She's like, this is not the same as before. For my grandfather, they had to like take everything he owned. And then we know his brothers were killed. We never saw them after that. Like, that was his breaking point. I've spoken to parents where some left the minute the conflict started. Others, they woke up one day and looked out the window and everything was rubble around them. And they're like, oh, I should probably try and get out right now. And it's different for everyone. And some don't end up making it out because they wait too long.
So your family did well in Jordan. Is that right?
Yeah, they did. I mean, my grandfather built himself up again. And my father's family was well established in Jordan. We didn't struggle. The family was educated. Jordan hadn't started with refugee camps back then, at least not for Syrians. So they were able to integrate and start up a lot quicker and with some more stability than others have.
So there was a certain point in your childhood where your grandmother took you to a refugee camp in Jordan. I guess by that time they had been set up. Say a little bit about that and what she told you as you guys left the refugee camp.
Yeah, I mean, my grandmother, probably the most important, influential person in my life. But she never forgot that experience, always identified as Syrian, and never wanted to forget that. Like, that is part of what shaped her and who she was. So at a young age, she took me to a Palestinian refugee camp on the outskirts of Amman, about 45 minutes from where we lived. And, you know, I was like I was a kid. I didn't want to go. Like, grandmothers are supposed to spoil you. They're not supposed to take you to see hard things. And she took me with her. I was really uncomfortable when I first got there. It was poverty that I hadn't seen before. People living in tents, squalor, very dense. And she would visit regularly and go around and visit with the different women in the camp. And so when I got there, I was just hanging on to her. And she's like, go play with the kids. And I was like, I don't want to play with them, because I thought they were beneath me, or they were scary, like they're different than me. You know, and she knelt down and very firmly said, go play with them and don't come back until you've done that. And so I did. I learned very quickly not to always listen to what my grandmother says. So I did that and went out, and there were kids playing soccer. I sat and watched and eventually ended up joining that game. And it was the great equalizer. We found something we had in common. We were playing. They were better than I was at it. And on our way out, I was telling her that I played. You know, I wanted her approval that I did what she said. And then I told her, haram, It's an Arabic word, has two meanings, and I used the meaning of poor them, like we feel sorry for them. And then she's like, no, haram on us. And she used the word sin. Haram also means sin, that we were sinning and that we should always believe in them, not feel sorry for them. And that kind of stuck with me. It's like, yeah, why are we feeling sorry for them? We should be believing them and taking care of people who live an hour away from us. So that's always stuck with me and definitely came back to focus 20 years after that experience.
So she instilled in you a sense of responsibility to others.
Yeah, and to always remember where we came from, and that where we came from is something beautiful and something to be proud of. And if we've had to leave a place, doesn't mean we're weak. It means we're strong. Yeah, a very big sense of responsibility and that sense of like, yeah, we're privileged, and that comes with a lot of responsibility.
And, you know, as part of being privileged, you were able to go to Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. I spent 25 years in that area in the Pioneer Valley before coming to live here in New York on Long Island. But when you graduated, you actually applied for and received refugee status. On what basis?
So being gay is a social group. That's the category our legal system classifies it as. And so I applied for asylum based on my membership in a social group. I'm hoping they change that language at some point because it's awkward and a mouthful. But in Jordan, you can get the death penalty for being gay. I knew very early on that I was, and that was not going to change. And those things were never going to work where I was born. I think 4 days after my commencement ceremony, I had my asylum hearing in Boston. And then 30 days later, I found out that I was approved. It was a tough decision. Like, it was, how do you choose your family, everything you know, country that you love, with your like personal freedom and right to live. I just hope people never ever have to make those decisions, but around the world, hundreds of thousands of people have to every day. And I was lucky. I had access to an attorney. My Smith classmates helped me research my case file. I had letters of support from the college president to one of our professors, an expert in Middle Eastern studies, and consulted with the State Department. But it was a really tough process. And I remember getting the approval letter. I'd received it at the mailbox at college and just sitting on the sidewalk. And I was crying because it was like the news I wanted. You know, it was like the happiest day of your life was also the saddest.
The saddest because?
It was the saddest because I lost my home. I knew I was going to lose my family. I was no longer Jordanian. And then here I was in a country all by myself.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Luma Mufle about her book, Learning America, One Woman's Fight for Educational Justice for Refugee Children. So you ultimately moved down south to Atlanta, Georgia, which is where you were when you encountered this ragtag group of soccer players. You asked them if they wanted to be a team, and they did. You became their coach. When you organized them, they kind of lacked discipline. Tell us what happened at the first game they had with others and what it taught you.
The first game was a disaster. It's like I'd been coaching for 4 years. I coached during my time at Smith and in Jordan, but I never had a team like this. And there were lots of things I just assumed they knew. Everything from showing up on time to being prepared to eating before your game. Very disorganized when they got on the field, very frazzled as well, very nervous. Like, to them, this was a game. Like, in their heads, it was the World Cup. And for me, it was like, nope, we have this every weekend. We're going to be playing every single weekend. and just fell apart, yelling at each other, not communicating with each other, finger pointing at each other. They had incredible individual skills, incredible one-touch passing, controlling the ball, but they didn't know how to work as a team. And so I had to change everything about the way I coach. I had to prepare them for every part of it, everything from wearing your shin guards to how you line up when the referee calls your name to subbing in and out to doing throw-ins. But I feel everybody learns from their losses. Those are the times where you get better. And that was eye-opening for me.
And you did finally whip them into shape. They became a champion team. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I believe most teams can turn into championship teams with the right discipline and structure and the heart to want to play and get better. But you have to play as a team. You can't have, at least in soccer, you can't be like an individual superstar. And it took some time, but by the end of the season, we were winning every single game by a lot. And it felt good. It felt good for them to also see that, right? Went from losing terribly to improving.
That's great. Now, what were some of the reactions from other teams that the Fugees experienced?
It was a mix. A lot of soccer in the United States is a middle-class, upper-middle-class sport. It's predominantly white. And so think about a group of kids coming in, every shade, every skin color, coached by a woman, and then all their names are not familiar, right? And so the referees would have a hard time reading their names, sometimes mock it or want to skip over it. Other kids, there'd be times where they'd be told to go back where they came from, or if they had Muslim names associated with the Taliban. But again, it was a learning opportunity to teach kids to walk away, to hold their head up high, to not respond to hate. When people say that, that's a reflection on them, not us. And we're here to play, and we're going to play with strength and dignity. But it's hard. It's hard to watch kids have to learn that at such a young age. And then some people were curious. They wanted to know, like, what is this team? Like, yeah.
And the age, these were middle school kids, is that right?
Yeah, middle school, 12, 13.
So talking about schools, tell us about the schools that refugee kids are put into when they first come to this country.
Yeah, so all over the country, you know, when refugees or newly arrived immigrants come in, they're placed in the age-appropriate class, not the level appropriate. So if you have a kid that comes here age 12, 13, they're placed in seventh or eighth grade, expected to know how to do pre-algebra, read a textbook, even though they may not know a word of English. In some districts, they may get 1 hour or 2 hours of English language support a day. Some may not. Some schools will have a newcomer program where they bring you in for 3 to 6 months, then place you back in. And it's just a logical way of doing it. Like if a kid doesn't know the letters of their alphabet, why are you placing them in seventh grade?
Some of these kids didn't know how to read. Some of these kids, in fact, had never gone to school because they had been in refugee camps.
Yep. I mean, we had kids that were born into refugee camps, never spent a day in school. We had kids that had gone to school in their home countries, but then war broke out and they're out of school for 5 years and they'd never learned in English. And this is just like the academic piece. We're not talking about any of the trauma that they've experienced before coming. And to me, it just felt like it was a backward approach. There was one moment where I realized one of my players couldn't read. We were doing some homework after practice. He'd asked for help. Said he had a headache, if I could read the worksheet to him. And so I did, and I filled it out, did it 2 days in a row, the third day, you know, I said, something's not right. And so I said, hey, Lewis, I have a headache. He's like, oh, I have a headache. And luckily I'm a little bit more stubborn than he is. And he eventually looked up at me and said, coach, I can't read. And I was floored. He had been in the country for 3 years and couldn't read. My parents sent me to British and American schools growing up because they believed Western education was the best the world had to offer. And I naively believed that all American schools were like the State Department run high school I went to in Amman. And even though I'd read about this in college and studied, it's different when you see it and feel it and you have that relationship with the kid that's being affected. And I felt I was 2 degrees removed from that experience. Like if I didn't have an education, that would have been me, that would have been my family. And that's wrong. And so my players are like my kids. I do anything for them. And so I ended up starting a school for 6 of my players, hired 1 teacher, got a donated church basement, and then it grew from there.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Luma Mufle about her book, Learning America, One Woman's Fight for Educational Justice for Refugee Children. So you are the founding director of the Fugees family, in which this school is one of. Talk a little bit about that process of starting a school. I mean, when did you realize? At first, it was not meant to be an entirely separate school. Talk about when did you realize that you actually had to start a school for refugee kids, one that wouldn't just feed into the mainstream system that was failing them?
I mean, it was, you know, we pulled the first group of kids out. They made such great progress. More and more of the players wanted to join. We were under the homeschool umbrella when we first started, even though we had a exceptionally qualified teacher, but that was the quickest way we could do it. Like for me, it's like, we need to get this stuff done. We can't waste another month, another day. And so not a lot of planning went into it. It's like, all right, let's start at the very beginning. The kids don't know the alphabet. That's where we start. And we work our way up with them. And in 3 years, Lewis was reading Harry Potter after being in our school. Our initial plan was, okay, we have the kids for 3 years, year round, and then we mainstream them back in. But our public schools are failing in Atlanta, the district we're in. And so after we put a few kids back in, they started floundering again. And so we ended up going through a high school. We were accredited in 2013 by the Southern Association of Independent Schools and Advanced Ed. And we're very proud of our schools. They treat kids with respect and dignity and have high expectations and believe they can achieve whatever they set their minds to. But there's a lot of accountability. There's a lot of account. You're not going to get passed through. You've got to know your stuff before you move on to the next level.
Right. You don't believe in social promotion. I know social promotion, you know, it has, I mean, the theory behind it is that it's more harmful for kids to be held back. I mean, there are studies showing that if you let a kid back even once, that they have a far less chance of graduating high school. So talk about how you deal with the social promotion. Oh, and by the way, we should note that your schools are free. And also talk about the admissions process. Yes. You don't exactly let in the you know, I guess what they call the best and brightest. They may be the best and brightest, but not academically.
Yeah, not yet, right? I think for, like, back to your question about social promotion, I actually think it's more harmful to do social promotion than hold kids back, because at which point is it too far gone that there's no hope at the end? You know, you keep promoting a kid. What are their possibilities and options after high school if they can't put a paragraph together? And that's not just refugee kids. This is all over the country. I actually got a FaceTime call from one of my seniors Monday, and she had been accepted into Kennesaw State University, her first choice, super excited. But I met her 8 years ago. She's originally from Sudan, came to our school. And when she came to us, she should have been in seventh grade. That's where her middle school had placed her. And you know, I spoke to her mom. I said, I can't put her in seventh grade. I'm going to put her in our sixth grade, which starts the kids with a K-3 curriculum. and explain to the mom why. You know, like, it's not that your kid is not smart. It's that your kid doesn't know English and she needs to work hard. And, you know, she hadn't been in school for 7 years. And so her mom agreed. We put her in sixth grade. She grew. But by the end of eighth grade, she was maybe at a fifth, sixth grade level. And when our students are testing academically at that, by the end of eighth grade, we recommend that they repeat their eighth grade year with us, because we want them to be prepared for success in high school, because high school, there's not a lot of flexibility, right? Credits are on the line, the clock is ticking. And her mom agreed. And so she's graduating, yes, at the age of 20, but she is very well prepared to succeed.
You were also accused of having a segregated school. So talk about this word segregation, and what did that whole argument mean to you? I think what's so interesting is that it shows the difference between idea and practice.
Yeah, I mean, like, we wanted a school for the kids who needed it. And when you've left your home and you're coming to a new country and you're trying to deal with where you fit in, throwing kids to an environment where they don't understand it all is not healthy. And sometimes you need to be surrounded by others like you so you can feel confident in who you are. And that's why our schools are for refugee and immigrant kids. You know, lately we've been highlighting a lot of the HBCUs. I went to Smith College. We talk about that in higher ed, but we don't talk about that in K-12. And I think there's a place for it. It doesn't have to be forever, but for people to integrate successfully, they have to know who they are. They have to feel confident in who they are. They have to be in an environment where people understand them, can pronounce their names correctly, where they can ask things about American culture and American schools that they would be mocked of, made fun of if they did that in their class. And our students have incredible success after they leave us because we've prepared them and they know who they are. They're not trying to assimilate and hide who they are. They understand everything about, well, most things about their new home. Does that answer it?
Yes. Now, these kids have been through unthinkable trauma. Talk about how the school deals with that history of trauma with the kids.
I mean, we have a simple approach. Kids that have fled trauma need consistency. They need predictability. So our structure is very predictable. It's the same. We describe our school as military meets Montessori.
Explain what that means.
So military, we have a lot of rules that we expect everybody to follow. It's the community aspect. You take care of your everybody in your in the military's your troop. You leave no one behind. And the Montessori is every kid learns at their own pace. And that's what the environment needs to be in the classroom. Montessori also uses a lot of multisensory instruction, which is super important for all kids, especially English language learners. A lot of studies lately have been saying that sports and the arts help with trauma. They're one of the most powerful ways. And I've always known that. The things that got me through living in Jordan, being in an area that's surrounded by war, or sports and the arts, and they're in our schedule every single day for every kid. They're not an add-on. They're not an elective. They're not, I can pull you out of that class. They are as core as English and math. They're very healing. Even our bells are music. We play classical music for transition and a fun song at the end of the day. We don't want to surround the environment with jarring noises that sound like institutional or prison-like environment. Schools feel at home, pictures of kids all over the walls, artwork.
And you put a big emphasis on building community at the school. And one of the ways that you do that is by making grades a communal effort with everybody feeling responsible for everyone's success. How does that work?
Our students read their report cards in front of the whole school. And this is not a shaming exercise, not to be like, hey, you failed. It's for everyone to know who is struggling in our community, who needs some help. And it's every single person in that room's responsibility to know what role they can play. And so you'll see if a student has an F, their neighbor will start bringing them to school, right? Like if they have an F because of excessive absences, all of a sudden it's not just us calling home. It's their classmate or their teammate saying, hey, come on, let's get up, wake up, let's go. If someone needs help in after-school tutoring, the older students are coming in and helping that kid. You're seen, right? Like so much of our culture right now is, well, if you fail at something, you just got to hide it. It's like, no, like, let's talk about it and let's see who's going to help us get out of it. Instead of, we acknowledge who are like, which students make honor roll, right? And by doing that, we kind of just like hide everybody else who's struggling and not talk about, well, what should we be doing? And we also do it in front of all the teachers, because sometimes a teacher can reach a kid that another one can't. And that conversation ends up being really powerful. It's like, hey, you know, you have an A in my art class. Why is your math grade so low? Like, talk to me about how we can work on this.
And there's no shame. I mean, because this is a real issue you also tackle in the book, Learning America, is how often refugee children feel shame. They're made to feel shame by the dominant society. So how do you make sure that that shame gets counteracted in your schools?
I mean, so much of what we do is building up their pride and their identity and who they are, explaining everything. We don't assume kids know. I mean, so many of our kids will come in and talk about like the horror story of learning how to use a dishwasher, right? We teach all that explicitly in our school. I think you have to see it to see like how kids feel when they see other kids care about them, instead of the experience of like, oh, I can't ask a question in a class because somebody might make fun of my accent. Well, in our school, everybody has an accent. Or my teacher can't pronounce my name. No, in our school, we spend hours during orientation learning how to pronounce the kids' names, bring parents in to help us with enunciation. And we always talk about like, hey, look at how far you've come, right? Yeah, you were at a kindergarten level when you started, but like in a year, you're at a 2.63, right? That's unheard of. And always showing that improvement. Yeah, you're struggling right now, but look at where you are now. And that's what makes people feel good, you know, having A's all the time. You're just like, okay, whatever. But showing like, hey, there is going to be struggle. There's going to be struggle in life. And it's how you deal with it that's going to determine your outcomes. And everybody will get an F at some point in their life. Might as well learn young on how to deal with it, right?
That's for sure. So how are you spreading this model beyond your own schools? You've got several schools already. Is there more than two? Is that right?
So we have two schools, one in Atlanta, Georgia, and one in Columbus, Ohio. Our schools operate under charter umbrella or voucher umbrella. And pre-pandemic, we were going to open more schools. But I think the pandemic just shook everybody. And, you know, we were seeing schools around the country struggle and kind of had to dig deep into what our role was going to be. We can open, you know, 10 more charters or voucher schools and have a sliver of the impact on a system that needs changing, and came back to the realization that if we want to change, we want to change the experience trajectory for every refugee and immigrant kid coming into the country, then we need to partner with districts. And so we launched what we are calling Project Taranga. It's a Senegalese word for community and hospitality. And we're partnering with districts to implement our model in their community. And since finishing the book, we started our first district partnership with Bowling Green, Kentucky. And we're super excited about it because that's when change happens. You have to work within the system to get some things going.
Well, that's terrific. And I have to say, this book was a page-turner. I read it in one sitting. It's beautifully written. And I actually cried at different parts in the book, tears of joy, because it is so moving to see kids whose lives have been so unimaginably impacted by war and, brutality and hatred, really get to have this wonderful experience, a kind of experience that really all schools should have. I mean, my son was a non-traditional learner. You know, he was diagnosed with ADHD, whatever. I mean, nobody ever really paid attention to what he could do or the ways he needed to learn. And he, ultimately decided school really wasn't for him. He's brilliant, but not a traditional learner. So I could see many ways in which your approach would be healthy for all students.
Yeah, I believe that. I believe so many kids don't learn the same way. In the same families, in the same cities, and yet we expect them to, and we don't see them, and then they end up leaving school or being discouraged or not feeling that they're smart. And that's our failure as adults, and we need to do better for them. I'm really glad you enjoyed the book and laughed and cried, and I think it is a hopeful book. There's so much that can be done, and our country is a country of solutions. Like we can do so much better, and I hope other communities can adopt it as well.
Yes. Luma Mufla, the book is Learning America, One Woman's Fight for Educational Justice for Refugee Children. I recommend it highly to my listeners, and thank you so much for talking with us here about it.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
Luma Mufla. Go to writersvoice.net to watch her TED Talk. Next up, Being the Change Against Climate Chaos. Stay tuned after the break.
Let me be the first to welcome you. It must have been so hard to leave your homeland. I can't begin to understand the trouble you've been through. Just let me be the first to welcome you.
Everyone Comes From Somewhere by Don Arbor. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On April 6, NASA climate scientist Peter Kalmus was arrested after chaining himself to a Chase bank. The action was part of global protests staged by Scientist Rebellion after the release of the most dire UN climate report ever. We spoke to him in 2017 about his book, Being the Change, which explores the connections between our individual daily actions and our collective climate predicament. Let's listen back to that now. I'm going to assume that you, like me, want to do our bit to save the environment. It's a popular idea. A recent survey shows that 88% of Americans agreed the average person should be taking concrete steps to reduce his or her environmental impact. Yet each day, we contribute more to it. It's inevitable. We need to use cars to get around. We need to heat our homes. Many of us eat meat. We don't yet have the infrastructure to make it easy to be green. And what good would it do anyway? It's a drop in the bucket, right? But my guest, climate scientist Peter Kalmus, says it's easier, more fun, and more effective than you think to change your life and the world to make a better environment. He began by bicycling, growing food, meditating, and making other simple changes. Turns out, he slashed his climate impact to under a tenth of the U.S. average and became happier in the process. His book, Being the Change, explores the connections between our individual daily actions and our collective environmental predicament. Peter Kalmus is a climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Peter Kalmus, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your book, Being the Change, the first sentence is really striking because I'm there very often myself. You say, I knew that burning fossil fuels was causing irreversible harm to our planet's life support systems, and yet I continue to burn. So this is the dilemma we are all in.
Yeah, well, those of us who actually understand the seriousness of global warming, that's true. And, you know, fossil fuels, burning fossil fuels is what's causing global warming. But almost everything we do in daily life is driven by fossil fuels. So it's quite a dilemma. And it connects this global predicament to our like everyday moment by moment daily life.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, there are many people. I mean, I remember recently I actually was talking to someone who was a marine scientist who was very much passionate about protecting marine species. And yet when I said to him something about ocean oil drilling, he said, well, actually, he wasn't a marine scientist. That is the difference. He was someone who was involved in working with scientists to protect the ocean. He said, well, did you use a car to come here? Well, of course I did. There's no mass transportation. So, you know, we're stuck in a way, aren't we?
So I've reduced my dependence on fossil fuel by about a factor of 10 over what it was in 2010. And, you know, it was about the U.S. average back then. So I still emit about 2 metric tons of CO2 per year. You know, that's from cooking and natural gas, a little bit of driving, buying some stuff, you know, buying some new stuff. So, you know, a little bit from food. So it's very hard to get away from it entirely, given that our systems, our daily life systems, our food systems, transportation systems, you know, entertainment systems, commerce systems, everything is set up to run on fossil fuels right now. So to make attempts to step out of that is really changing that system, which is difficult. It's difficult to imagine how to do that, and it's difficult to implement that. You know, I've got 2 boys, and our school is about a mile away. We walk or bike with them every morning, and then they come home on their own. But we're about the only ones in the whole school who do that. Everyone else is, you know, driving there. And this is just the way the systems have kind of evolved, I guess, over the last couple hundreds of years. I think it's quite easy for the average American to drastically reduce their emissions, maybe by a factor of 2. It took a little bit more effort. It's sort of like a hobby for me to go to reduce it by a factor of 10 to 1/10. To go further than that would be very difficult until the systems start to change. But then the question is, how do we get the systems to change as individuals? And I think one response, there's many, many responses to that question. But one response is we simply do try in our own lives to move away from fossil fuels and explore alternatives. And that will help increase demand for those alternatives. That'll help show our neighbors and our friends and our family members that it's possible to live with less fossil fuels. And then once the systems start to change, then it'll be possible to get, you know, completely away from them, which unfortunately is what we need to do if we want to avoid the worst, most catastrophic consequences of climate change.
Right. You talk about going beyond fear and guilt, environmentalism. So how do you motivate people?
Well, that's a great question. You know, one of the hardest things to do is to persuade someone else to change in some way. Certainly, you know, before I started reducing my own use of fossil fuels, I felt like, you know, I got the seriousness of global warming, and I think it's far more serious than the average person thinks, speaking as sort of a citizen and as an atmospheric scientist with a front row seat to the changes that are happening to the Earth right now that we're causing. It's very, very serious. But before I started to change, you know, I think when I told people, oh, it's serious, we got to stop burning fossil fuel, they didn't take me very seriously. You know, I think they thought that I was kind of preaching at them. It probably made them feel a little bit guilty. So when I started reducing my own fossil fuel use, you know, all I did was I would do it. And I'd say, hey, I tried this thing and it, you know, made me happier. I really enjoy biking instead of driving. You know, gardening is great. And I just do this stuff. And then people kind of see me and they see me doing something with a smile and they're like, oh, he's really enjoying that. And then I think it plants the seed in their mind and then they start doing, you know, similar. And then, of course, you know, hide what I'm doing. I write about it. I write for a magazine called Yes Magazine. You know, I wrote this book in an attempt to help other people imagine a life with far less fossil fuel, to make that seem less alien to them and to help shift the culture in that way. And I think we have to explore this together as communities. Everyone's going to come at this with a slightly different point of view, and they're going to experiment in slightly different ways, and we can learn from each other and support each other.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with climate scientist and suburban father of two, Peter Kalmus, about his book, Being the Change. It's about how to live well and spark a climate revolution. You say the path is through head, hands, and heart. What do you mean by that?
Right. So my kind of first response to global warming was intellectual. So I'm a scientist. I was trained as a physicist. And, you know, when I started realizing that this was a serious thing, this was in 2006, you know, I was kind of late to the game. A lot of people realized it was serious long before I did. But when I finally realized it, and kind of having my first child was a huge catalyst for this, because I suddenly was like, you know, what kind of world are they going to have? And it kind of woke me up. But my response was to read scientific papers. And, you know, after many papers and like a year of kind of learning about it, I was like, you know, this is really serious. This is real. You know, I had some kind of fundamental understanding of the science. And I went around, you know, shaking people by the lapels, like I said, and saying, hey, look, here's the science. We have to change. And that got me nowhere. So, so the hands means actually doing stuff. So that was kind of getting involved, looking at my own life, saying, you know, rolling up my sleeves, saying, all right, here's where my emissions are coming from. You know, 75% from flying, you know, a second biggest source of emissions was from food, from a meat diet. Then, you know, how can I stop driving so much? So I looked at my life and said, you know, here's where it's coming from. Now, how can I get that out of my life? Because I don't like burning it anymore. The harm fossil fuels is causing was very clear to me. And I don't want to harm others. That's like a fundamental principle in my life. And that's where the heart kind of comes in, right? So what I'm doing, the changes that I'm making are easy for me to sustain and easy for me to keep exploring this and easy for me to write about, because everything I do is coming out of love. So, you know, when I had my kids, it just completely revolutionized how I thought about myself and other people and how I felt about love. You know, having kids is it's like a titanic event in someone's life, I think. And as I kind of integrated that with my understanding of global warming, I started, you know, thinking about other people's kids too, and kids that weren't born yet, and other animals on this planet that are going extinct and that don't have a voice. So it was like this huge wave of love for the entire biosphere, and like a deep sense of humility that I exist at all, you know, that the biosphere gives me everything that I need to survive, the air that I'm breathing right now, clean water to drink, good food, you know, an avocado tree in my backyard, a tree that makes avocados. And what could be more miraculous than that? So that's the heart. And I think all three of them, for me at least, for my path, were important, and they kind of support each other.
So let's get down to some brass tacks here. Hopefully they're not too carbon emitting themselves. What are some ways that people can begin? I mean, you've mentioned a few, but tell us some other ones.
Right. Well, you know, it's hard for me to kind of give a prescription to someone else, right? So the point of view of my book is to say, here's what I did. You know, and I hope it gives other people ideas and I hope that it helps inspire them to kind of explore things on their own. You know, I think that probably pretty universally, though, a good place to start is to actually understand where your emissions are coming from. So I mean, there's this question that's hanging out there, I think, that maybe we need to address, which is, why is there any point in an individual reducing his or her emissions at all? right? So a lot of environmentalists say that it's a mistake to focus on individual change because we need change at the systems level. This is urgent, and individual change is not going to solve the problem. It's not going to happen quickly enough. And frankly, they're basically right. But my answer to them is it's not an either or thing. It's an all of the above thing. And, you know, furthermore, I think maybe part of why there hasn't been a lot of progress at the systems level, at least in my opinion, on climate action, is maybe because there haven't been that many individuals willing to change. There haven't been a lot of leaders on climate, activist leaders, scientist leaders, who say this is important enough that I'm going to dramatically reduce my own emissions, right? If a climate leader isn't reducing his or her own emissions and is in fact emitting more than the average American, what kind of a message does that send? You know, that sends a message that this isn't really that important. Or maybe it sends a message that it's still socially acceptable to burn fossil fuels. It says, you know, even if someone who cares about it this much isn't reducing, that kind of implies that it's essentially impossible to reduce, right? And that's kind of a demoralizing message. So I think it's very important to tell this story that it's quite possible to reduce, it's not that hard, and that there's a lot of benefits to your life in addition to not emitting that much fossil fuel, you know, like riding a bike. It's super fun. That was a huge surprise to me. I started riding a bike. When I started riding my bike, it was because I didn't want to emit the CO2 from burning that gasoline. But what I found was it was super fun, and it got me healthier, and I really enjoy it. And I would keep riding my bike as much as I do now, even if there was no global warming, just because it's such a wonderful part of my life. So that's, you know, you get all of these extra benefits, and then you're telling the story that it is possible to reduce. Now, how can other people start doing this? I think it's important for them to find ways to kind of live outside of the status quo fossil fueled system that they really enjoy. So, you know, they could try traveling more slowly, you know, traveling by train, which I find enjoyable. I get a lot of work done when I'm on trains, you know, traveling by car, even long distance travel by bicycle. They could try, you know, becoming vegetarian. They can try getting more involved with their community. They can write, they can do art, you know, whatever someone's talents or interests lie, there's some way to connect that to helping shift the culture on global warming. And once we start shifting this culture, then I think the space gets opened up for systems level change and for policy level change, because as the culture shifts, people are going to demand that their elected leaders do something about global warming. And those elected leaders are going to fear that they'll lose their positions if they don't. So the cultural shift shifts to translates to a shift at the voting booth, which translates to a shift in the way policies get crafted. So I think that there's a very important connection between individual level change and systems level change, which is currently underappreciated in the environmental movement.
I think that's a terrific point. You know, you think about, for example, I grew up, let's see, I was born in 1949. My mother, of course, went through World War II, so she was subject to all the kinds of energy savings that were really pushed by the government. It was a cultural shift. When I grew up, we always had to turn off the lights. I mean, it was just, you know, if you weren't using the light, you turn it off.
Yeah, that's a cultural shift. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Cultural difference. Yeah, I tell my kids, you know, you wouldn't leave the water running in the bathroom and walk out. Well, why would you leave the light running? Why would you leave the electricity running? Right. And it's a shift towards viewing all of these resources that we have. Clean water is precious. Electricity is so useful, right? It's allowing us to have this conversation. And fortunately, there's a way to it's becoming easier and easier to generate electricity without using fossil fuels. But, you know, I think if we stop taking all of the stuff we take for granted, you know, food's a big one for me. I think that gratitude toward food is a major way to change the mindset, and it's a way to feel humility and like we're not, you know, better than other species on this planet, you know, that we're, it's a way to remind us that we're integrated into the web of life. And I feel like our society has lost, really to a large extent, gratitude for food, and we basically take it for granted. So I don't know, personally, my own life has become greatly enriched by having more gratitude for these things. I actually would go so far as to say that gratitude is a necessary ingredient to happiness. It's very hard, I think, at least for me, to be happy if I'm taking everything for granted, right? Because we're surrounded by miracles. Just the fact that we're here at all and having this conversation, quite frankly, it's a kind of miracle. And how sad is it that when we have all of these miracles in our lives, we can still feel, you know, unhappy and depressed and bored, right? And that's a function, I think, of taking things for granted. And it's just a slight shift, you know, a slight shift sideways in how you view the world. And, you know, you can see your neighbors as kind of this amazing resource, or you can see them as sort of annoying, I guess. And
yeah, and actually, Peter Kalmus, you do talk about not just doing this on the individual level, nor doing it on the whole system-wide level, but on the community level as well, in your book, Being the Change. So talk a little bit about community networks. What do you mean by that?
Well, so, you know, it's very hard to kind of, for a normal person like me, to kind of make direct changes, you know, at the national level or at the international level. But, you know, it's possible for me to change myself, and it's possible for me to have some effect at the community level. And there's a lot going on in anyone's community, and it's just a question of tapping into it. I mean, in my community, there's something called a transition town where, you know, people get together who are kind of interested in exploring transitioning away from fossil fuels. They set up things like repair cafes, which is kind of a monthly event where people can bring broken stuff and clothes with rips in them and have it repaired, you know, to try to keep things out of the landfill. And when we first started doing the repair cafe, we kind of expected people to have this utility by bringing their stuff in, but we didn't really expect all of the smiles that happened, you know, both from the people who are sort of the quote customers, it's totally free, but even more so from the people who are doing the repairs. You know, they're just super happy to help other people and to, you know, to use their skills and feel appreciated. So there's an intrinsic joy in serving others that really comes out once you start kind of getting more involved with the community, and becomes a lot more than just words. It becomes, you know, you experience this joy. And I think that if you haven't been that involved in community, once you start getting involved, you kind of realize, how could I have been missing this in my life for so long? It's kind of a relief to become engaged in that way, I think.
That sounds like such a great idea. And there are many other, you know, I have one thing I wanted to ask you, going back just to the individual level. You talk about opting out of a broken system and like packaging. And I know I go crazy with all the plastic that I have to get my things in. Now, of course, if, you know, if we have a repair cafe, I may not have to buy something that's new that comes in clamshell packaging, but I inevitably have to buy some things. So what's your suggestion on packaging?
Right. Well, that's it's interesting. I think about the waste that we produce in my household. There's not a lot of garbage, you know, but there's one of those tall kitchen bags in our kitchen. And after every like 3 weeks, it fills up basically with plastic from food packaging mainly. You know, recycling goes out about once every week or once every other week, and there's like some boxes in there, and there's other plastic that's recyclable. But it's, you know, the further I go in this, the more I kind of abhor plastic. It's amazing to compost. One of the things I love doing is composting. It, you know, that keeps organic matter, most organic matters, especially food and yard waste, it keeps that out of the landfills where it would otherwise turn into methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas. But it's funny because then I spread the compost on my garden and I'm constantly picking out those little labels from fruit, which they make out of plastic for some reason. I mean, it's not very much plastic, but it's kind of creepy, you know, sort of almost like in sort of a supernatural way, how everything breaks down in the compost and turns into this beautiful kind of like dark brown, loamy, you know, plant food, except for the plastic. And it stays like as pristine as it was when it was produced, and it's very weird and kind of, in some sense, it feels sort of unnatural. So, you know, I try to buy food in bulk. We're vegetarians, so we actually really enjoy eating beans and rice in various forms. So we'll buy like a big 25-pound bag of beans and a 25-pound bag of rice. And interestingly, that comes packaged usually in paper and not in plastic, which is really nice. We get a lot of the plastic that does end up in our recycling and our garbage comes from food that we get from supermarket spoils. So, you know, the supermarket, when the food items pass the expiration date, they throw it away. And so I save some of that food for my family because, you know, it takes a lot of fossil fuels to produce that food in the first place. And then if it just ends up in the landfill, again, it turns into methane, which is a strong greenhouse gas. So it's kind of a double benefit to save food from the waste stream. And 40% of the food in the United States goes right into the landfill, by the way, which is kind of crazy. So that's a broken system that needs to get fixed for sure. You know, there's people that don't have enough food, and yet 40% of the food in the United States is getting thrown away. So I haven't found a way to completely eliminate plastic for my life. I think that would be about equally difficult as completely eliminating fossil fuels. But, you know, I definitely prefer buying food products and buying other products that don't have a lot of plastic packaging. And, you know, again, it's a cultural shift kind of thing, right? If enough people get tired of all the plastic, you know, and there's more and more articles being written about plastic in our oceans and how that plastic is ending up in the food chain and how even the water we drink in America has, you know, microfiber plastic in it now. So if you just go to your tap, get a glass of water, there is our little particles of plastic in there that are too small to see. And we don't know what the health effects of this are yet. So as more and more people start to learn about this and how it's just pervasive in our entire environment now, and do we really want it to be like that, then hopefully we'll start to shift away from all the plastic packaging, but that's going to be a slow process. You can fight, by the way, you can fight for, you know, not having plastic bags in your community, like from retailers, and you can fight for, you know, ordinances to not have styrofoam packaging in, you know, single use from restaurants. And, you know, we've done both of those things here in Pasadena. So, but it's really hard to convince city councils of that. And, you know, the commerce groups push back really hard against it. So it's, you know, that's another way to connect with your community is at the sort of kind of community politics level and the city council level.
Well, that's great. We actually did get rid of plastic bags in our town, of course, not in the whole county. I guess that's next. And then the country. But that's a great example of moving from the individual to the community and even larger, of which there are many such examples in your book, Being the Change. Peter Kalmus, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. This is an easy read and a heartening one. Being the Change. Thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me. What a pleasure.
Peter Kalmus is a climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. You can read an excerpt from his book, Being the Change, by going to writersvoice.net. Peter Kalmus talking to us in 2017. Here's a clip of Kalmus breaking down in tears in front of Chase Bank at a protest against the bank's continuing investment in fossil fuels.
So I'm here because scientists are not being listened to. I'm willing to take a risk for this gorgeous planet, for my sons. And we've been trying to warn you guys for so many decades that we're heading towards a f***ing catastrophe. And we've been being ignored. The scientists in the world have been being ignored. And it's got to stop. We're going to lose everything. And we're not joking.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.